Hello and welcome to a special American Magazine podcast. I'm joined with Father Jim Martin. Welcome, Father Jim.
Great to be here.
We're here to discuss, do our annual wrap-up of the show Mad Men. This is a guilty pleasure for us, but a couple shows deserve the America podcast treatment. One, we did a Downton Abbey podcast, and now we're doing a Mad Men, at least for the second time, I think.
Yes, which Tim and I do every Monday morning, exactly. Actually.
So if there's any other show you want to get the podcast treatment, you let us know, and we will try to watch. All right, Jim, well, let's start with your general impressions of season, is it five now, I believe?
I guess we should know that. I think it is season five, yeah.
What was your general impressions of the arc of the season, and what were the important themes?
I felt that the season always, like all the Mad Men shows, held my interest. I guess the big theme for me was Don and Megan, how the marriage was going to work out. The ad agency, how well they did financially, and then some of the characters, the smaller characters who had some really big personal moments, like Lane, which we'll talk about, it, and also Peggy's eventual exit. But I thought Don and Megan were kind of the fulcrum of the season.
Well, I should mention that we are going to give away some plot points. If you haven't seen the whole
spoiler
season,
alert,
you may not want to listen. So yeah, let's talk about Don and Megan. It went in a very interesting direction. You kind of were expecting Megan just to be kind of this, a secretary that he marries, not a serious woman. But she turns out to be, as we were, I was just reading, she has more emotional intelligence than anybody on the show.
Which is not hard.
Exactly.
But the other thing was, you remember at the beginning of the season, some people thought that, they'd come back and Don would have divorced her or something because it was so ridiculous, at the end of last season, that he would have married the secretary who he knew for, such a short period of time. She's very young, and yet she seems to make him happier than Betty did. She's also a more well-rounded character, I think, than Betty. Betty comes off as kind of plastic, I think, and maybe that's the intention. But Megan is this kind of vivacious and fiery person who, is not without her problems, but she seems to connect with Don, and she also seems to challenge him more as she did at the Howard Johnsons.
Yes, maybe you could talk about that team. I mean, time and again, she seems to kind of challenge him to, be a better man or be a better father, and that's one example.
I think she is. They have this sort of spat in Howard Johnson's because he's trying to represent Howard Johnson's, and he basically tells her to fall in line. And I think she goes out on the lam, doesn't she? And
yes.
Has disappeared for what, overnight? And he's kind of shocked and very angry when does he find her back home in the apartment?
Eventually. Yeah, that's another clever, in this age of text and voicemails,
right.
You can't imagine ever losing contact with somebody for that long, but that's a sign of what it was like 40, 50 years ago. So, their relationship and the question of fidelity, that's an interesting theme. You keep expecting Don to start straying like he's done in earlier seasons, but he does not. So he seems to be keeping faithful to Megan.
Although he has that daydream. Remember when he's sick and you wonder if he's actually, cheating? There are a lot of opportunities for him to cheat, but he does want to stray, it seems, but she pulls him back. And I think it seems to me his love for her, I think, that's kind of keeping him from doing that. That's not to say that she comes from a completely normal family. Her mother, I think, just basically does whatever she wants sexually. It's like her mother's like Simone de Beauvoir or something. But, the mother of Megan and Roger Sterling had this affair. And so he seems to be trying to remain faithful in this world of infidelity all around him.
It's interesting because the show seems to be one of the themes is like how we are affected by the actions of our parents. And one of the characters who represents that is Sally, who is Don and Betty's daughter, and you wonder, well, what does this poor girl have to deal with? And, she's going to be in therapy for the rest of her life. But you look at somebody like Megan, who's a young woman who has it seems like a pretty dysfunctional family, but she comes out of it okay.
Mm-hmm. Even though she struggles. And I think I always feel sorry for her in her relationship with Don because she really is kind of, at his whim, how he wants to treat her. And I think he always has the upper hand. And I think, because he originally he was the boss, right? And I think there's still that dynamic going on. But you're right. I think she's a very attractive character, which is not something I would have imagined. I expected that you would come back from the show at the beginning of the season and they would be divorced, because it skipped a certain time period. But, there she is. And she's also, I admire her for trying to make a go of the acting career, which Don, I think, seems very conflicted about. I think he needs to be the head honcho. I think he still wants to be the boss.
Yeah, that's interesting because Betty, although she's not that much older than Megan, is from a different generation and is more in that, like, you stay home, you take care of the family. Whereas Megan, although they're a good match, she's definitely she's more of Peggy's generation because right. they're both young and kind of ambitious.
Right, right. And it's interesting that it's a totally different world, too. And he, I don't think he knows what to make about the acting world. He's much more the business guy. You know, and as the idea of him even kind of going to meet the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, who did they go to meet?
He go to see the Rolling Stones. I don't think they ever got to meet with them, but yeah.
And he's, you know, completely out of his element. So I think she represents that kind of different world, you know, that he's uncomfortable with. And I think that that creates some of the antipathy that you feel from him when she talks about her career.
And we should say this season begins in 1966, and the signs of the 60s are more evident in this episode, this season than previous seasons, in the decor of the offices, mm-hmm. also of Don's kind of swanky pad on Madison right. Avenue, but also in the question of race relations, which they take up in the first episode.
Yeah, I mean, they hire an African-American secretary, Dawn. People make fun of her name in the ad agency. And she goes over to Peggy's house. I guess, is there a blackout or something that she has to go
right,
to Peggy's
exactly,
house?
Yeah.
And you can see there's a really interestingly sort of played scene where Peggy leaves her purse on the living room table, and she's about to leave the room, I think, to let Dawn sleep overnight in the living room. And you can see Peggy's glance kind of going over to the purse, and the viewer is left to think that Peggy is worried that Dawn's going to steal some money from the purse or something. But I think Peggy, doesn't she kind of resist that temptation to say something? She just, you know, goes to bed and everything's okay.
Yes, and there's a similar scene with Lane in a cab where he is reluctant to give his wallet that he's found mm-hmm. to the black cab driver. So they start to explore this issue, but they don't return to it in the latter part of the season.
They kind of dropped it. I was surprised that, I mean, we have 68 coming up and, you know, things are heating up. And I was kind of surprised of how little the outside world intruded on things. It was mostly about the relationships, you know, among the characters and the business. But there wasn't a whole lot about race or the Vietnam War or anything like that, as much as I would have thought. I just thought that was kind of surprising. But they had a lot to cover in terms of everybody's relationships. I mean, you know, just between Peter and Don, that would have been enough for a whole season.
Well, yeah, Pete and Don, let's talk about them. They seem to be kind of the lodestars for this mm-hmm. season. Don always is, of course. But Pete, he got more focused this season, yeah. and he seems to be growing ever more dysfunctional.
He's a very sad character, I find. He had that fist fight with Lane, which was just crazy. Of course, you know, Roger Sterling said, you know, this was just fantastic. But they got into a dispute about, I think, some account, you know, who was going to, you know, be the lead person on the account. And, you know, Lane really clocked him. And it was kind of humiliating. And I think there's a scene where he's going down on the elevator, remember, with Don, and he's almost in tears. And he says something like, you know, my life is over, or he has this completely despairing comment. Do you remember what it was? Or
it was something along those lines. And I remember when we talked about it the next day, you started to wonder about, you know, is Pete going to do something drastic? Yeah. Is there going to be a suicide this season? And turned to be pressing. It wasn't Pete, but it was
Lane.
Poor Lane Price.
Who ironically bests Pete in the fight. But Pete, I think, you know, you had said earlier before we started this podcast that Pete seems to live by his own rules, and his code is to have no code. That's quoting Tim Reedy. And it's true. He's very, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say immoral. He's kind of amoral. He sleeps around with the wife of a guy that he meets on the train, which was kind of odd. He seems completely, to me, uninterested in his wife, Trudy, and living in the suburbs. He longs to be back in the city. And it's a kind of babyish attitude, it seems to me, that, you know, he just wants what he wants when he wants it. And yet sometimes he's very bold in the office. You know, he sort of puts his foot down and he does things. So to me, he's always seemed like the kind of kid brother that's trying to, you know, kind of prove himself to Don Draper and everybody else. And I don't think they take him as seriously as one another.
But the reality is, in this season, he's more successful than anybody else. I mean, he recruits a lot of new accounts. Don, by comparison, really isn't very productive or creative.
No, and there's not too many of those sort of Don Draper moments where he kind of gives these, like, sort of philosophical descriptions of the product. He did that for, what was it? Was it Philip Morris that he goes in and...
Oh, Dow.
Dow, that's right. He goes in and he talks about Dow, but there was a lot less of that, and I'm not sure if it's because he's delegating or because he's getting tired. He doesn't seem to be the brilliant, you know, ad exec that he did in the first couple of seasons, which I actually found a little baffling. I mean, he's almost kind of a sad sack in some of the episodes.
Yeah, there's one episode where he seems to get inspired, and he actually, you know, plays a little dirty with one of his other copywriters, and basically trashes his idea in favor of his own. So Don briefly
and leaves it in the cab without even presenting it to the client.
Yeah, so he gets inspired and he gets, but then later, you're right, he kind of falls back into the same old sad sack routine. It's hard to tell. I mean, on one hand, he seems happy at home. He's got a better life with Megan. Does that mean that he's less ambitious at work? I think that's one of the questions they're trying to explore.
Do you think he seems happy at home? I find the relationship so stormy, I guess. It's, you never know what's going to happen. It seems so predicated on their moods.
Right.
Especially Don's mood.
Yes. Although he does at points seem happier than he's ever been. I mean, there are moments where you say, oh, he really seems happy. But you're right. There are other moments where they're like wrestling on the floor and you've got, yeah, like, this is a mess. You know?
I think a lot, we mentioned earlier the idea of fidelity. I mean, I think he's struggling to be faithful. He's struggling to be faithful to the firm. Megan is struggling to be faithful to him, you know, and trying to negotiate the career. I also think, you know, I was very surprised. I think one of the most callous things I saw him do was throw money in Peggy's face when he was angry about, I think, a request she had to go to Paris or to be in a particular account. You know, I found, having worked at General Electric for 6 years, those kind of emotions over small things, over the, you know, who gets credit for what and who gets an office, and it can really build. And I found that the show really illustrates that very well. But I have to say, that was a really shocking moment. That was such a kind of, you know, when you think of money, it's a dirty thing, you know. I mean, it's physically dirty, and the image of just tossing money in somebody's face was just, that was kind of shocking. And frankly, I was expecting Peggy to leave after that.
Well, we should talk about Don and Peggy. We've said in previous podcasts, I mean, this is, I think, the most interesting relationship on the show. The fact that she left, that's a big deal, and kind of didn't get a full attention in the show.
Yeah, she leaves rather unceremoniously, and while they're all celebrating the approval of a new account, they've just scored Jaguar, I guess, and she just quits. And I think she's as she said to Don, you know, you would do the same thing. I thought a very kind of tender and odd moment when he kisses her hand, long lingering kiss, which I thought was a little, frankly, a little out of place for him. And then later at the very end of the season, she runs into him at a movie house, and they're both kind of playing hooky, trying to get ideas for a new account. And he's very friendly with her, you know, and she's friendly with him. So there's a lot of love there. And I think, you know, there's a little jealousy, too. I think Don's a little jealous of her moving up. And I think she probably needed to get out under his wings, because he really was kind of, I think he was preventing her from moving up. And I think it was a little bit of sexism, too, on his part.
Another thing about Peggy, she's in a relationship with this kind of alternative newspaper journalist who she's living with, and this causes something of a scandal with her mother.
Yeah, I mean, Peggy, we know from earlier episodes, comes from a very devout Catholic family, and it was actually kind of sort of comical or sad, depending on, you know, which way you look at it, that she went to a dinner with the fella, and she thought that he was going to propose, and instead he says, you know, will you live with me, basically. And then they invite the mother over for a celebratory dinner, and the mother just storms out, basically, because she's so appalled, doesn't she? She storms out, and what does she say?
Well, she basically says, you know, this sort of stuff has gone on all the time, but, you know, you don't need to rub my face in it. So the idea is that, you know, keep it behind closed doors, although, you know, Peggy, to her credit, wants to be honest about it. It's an interesting way they treated that whole thing, because Peggy is ambivalent about it. You know, she wants to be this new woman, but she also has kind of these traditional mores that she's also trying to honor. So it's a difficult struggle for her.
Yeah, and she's struggling. I mean, she smokes pot. She's kind of sleeping with this guy. She's kind of experimenting. I see her as someone who comes from a conservative background who's in this world of changing mores. I think it's interesting the way she relies on Joan a lot, too, you know, that she'll go on and kind of touch base with her. And I think Joan was the one who...
Yeah, Joan was the one who said that you're probably going to get a proposal when her boyfriend says, I wanted to have dinner with you. And it's interesting. Their relationship, like Don and Peggy's, is one of the more interesting ones on the show. And they're coming from two different generations. Joan is from Don's generation, but Peggy is this, you know, also Megan is also in the same generation, where they're ambitious, independent women who, you know, don't necessarily aspire to be married. That's not their highest goal in life.
Yeah, and I mean, Joan, it seems like she's someone who has been dealt with by men primarily through the way she looks, her appearance, and her body. People are always commenting on it. I would say it's fair to say she accentuates that, you know, by the way that she dresses. You know, Peggy is less kind of classically attractive, and people deal with her more with her mind. And I think there's a kind of jealousy, you know, maybe, or a little bit of a competition between the two, you know, in terms of how they see the world and how they act. And then, you know, the whole thing about Joan's body, I mean, that leads to, you know, some pretty dire circumstances later on in the season.
Well, the indecent proposal, you're right, exactly. Her body becomes a commodity, literally, mm-hmm. because that's what helped land them the big success of this season, which is the Jaguar account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really terrible. She is essentially offered up. He asks, doesn't he? The client asks Roger or Pete, I guess.
Pete and Kenny Cosgrove.
Yeah, Ken Cosgrove, very good. Whether or not, you know, Joan will sleep with him. And Pete, you know, broaches that topic in an extremely uncomfortable and, you know, really offensive conversation for Joan. And then there's this back and forth that I had a hard time following in terms of, you know, Lane comes in and says something. And then what does Don say? Does Don say you don't have to do it? Is that right?
Yes. Well, Don initially says we should not do this and storms out of the office, but they go ahead with it anyway. Mm-hmm. And then when he gets wind of it, he goes to her apartment and says, you know, you don't have to do this. Turns out it's already happened.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very creepy scene. And yet she, you know, you could say, I mean, I'm not a woman, so I can't say this, but, you know, she makes the decision. You know, she says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be partner. You know, you could say that she's in control of her body and she makes this decision. The sad thing is, you know, she's also trapped because she's a single woman. She has a child, and she probably feels forced to make this decision. So it's very kind of sad. I think, you know, we were talking about fidelity before. I think the relationship with her husband, you know, this like crumb bum, is kind of is a very sad relationship. He leaves essentially because I don't know what you think, but I don't think it's so much of devotion to the army as it is that he just loses interest in her and the baby.
It's not unlike what Pete's going through. I mean, mm-hmm. they're probably both around the same age, early 30s, mm-hmm. and they're just kind of disaffected and don't want to settle down. And they're looking for something exciting in their life. And for Pete, it's an affair, living in New York City. And for this guy, it's life, you know, it's fighting in Vietnam.
Yeah, but they both seem kind of babyish. I mean, exactly. Even though, you know, the guy's going off and doing something noble, he's, you know, I'm bored with being a husband. And Pete seems bored all the time. You know, he's bored or he's kind of ticked off or he's grumpy or sullen. And I think the last season, the last show, Trudy said, I'm tired of this. I'm, you know, why don't you just get the apartment in New York, which I thought, uh-oh, this is not, you know, bad idea, Trudy, you know, because he's going to be... He's going to be sleeping around, I'm sure, or drinking or whatever.
Right.
And that's a very unusual relationship, too, that Trudy and Pete. Because remember, her father, I think, had a lot of money, wasn't it? Isn't that the...
Yes.
And she was kind of in control at the beginning.
Right.
But, you know, even with the new pool designs, you know, Pete is not interested in the suburbs.
Now, one thing that we did want to touch upon before we end is the music and the way music kind of ties into this season. And you've got a couple episodes where you get introduced to the Rolling Stones because one client wants to use them on an account, and they try to go to visit the Stones. I guess it's at Shea Stadium.
Yeah.
And you start to see that Don, who you said this well, who is, you know, so cool for the whole series, is starting to look like a bit of a square in 1960s America.
Yeah, he's Joe Cool at the beginning. He's like the coolest guy ever. He dresses that way, you know, as they say, what is it, women want to be with him, men want to be him, that kind of stuff. And then he shows up at Shea Stadium, and you see him through her eyes, through this young girl, you know, the Beatles or Rolling Stones?
Rolling Stones
fans' eyes. And you see him as like dad, you know, this complete square, and he's kind of giving her a little talking to. And, you know, she's in these kind of hippie clothes, and he's in his skinny tie and his skinny suit, and he's getting old. And yet, ironically, and he has a hard time with the music. I mean, you were talking earlier, you know, in a private conversation about Revolver, the use of that album.
Yes, this is 1966. That's one of the seminal Beatle albums, comes out. Megan buys it, you know, very excited about it. This is an episode where they're trying to get Beatles-like music into a Hard Day's Night-themed ad, and one of the kind of the themes there is that, well, there was no Beatles-like music. Yeah. There was only Beatles
music.
Can't
get the Ruddles or
exactly.
anything like that, right?
And they play at the end of that episode that song, Tomorrow Never Knows, I believe, and you hear it, and it's just so different from, as you mentioned, you know, previous season, we were listening to Bye Bye Birdie.
Bye Bye Birdie, right, which is this sort of pop, you know, popcorn bubblegum music, and it's really kind of up. But, you know, I mean, it's, and that was the, and you can see Don, the look on his face is just complete incomprehension.
He doesn't get it. It's kind of Eastern, it's loud, mm-hmm. it's dissonant. Mm-hmm. He stops the record. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned that, you know, another song on that album is Eleanor Rigby, mm-hmm. which is, you know, look at all these lonely people.
Lonely.
Where did they all come from? And that could be the theme for this show.
Well, they all seem, everyone seems so lonely and seem really apart from one another. And, you know, one of the characters we haven't talked about yet is Roger Sterling, you know, who I find him fascinating because he, you know, at times you think he's Don's best friend. I mean, they'll go out drinking and they'll confide in one another. And at other times you just think this is a very superficial relationship and he is kind of lost. I mean, he takes LSD, you know, because he wants to be fulfilled and it makes him realize that he wants to be divorced from his wife. He gets divorced for the second time. He's, you know, he has this odd relationship with Megan's mother, you know, who is very odd, you know, and to accentuate her oddness, you know, she speaks in French a lot. And he just doesn't seem very happy. And I wonder sometime on what level does he really connect with his so-called best friend?
And remember that Roger's from the Greatest Generation. I mean, he's a World War II vet.
Right.
And you know, this is the generation that is supposed to be more mature and
more moral.
Moral than the 60s generation.
Right, and he's probably one of the most immoral people on the show. Right. I also wonder, you know, one of the things as a former GE young executive, a lot of these people don't do a lot of work. I mean, you know, Don's asleep. You know, I don't know what Roger does except go out to, you know, meals and, you know, hang out in his pop art office. I mean, Pete seems to work hard. Peggy works hard. Ginsburg works really hard.
He's carrying the place on his shoulders.
But the rest of them, I mean, Joan works hard. But, I mean, Roger and Don, I you know, and when Don started working, as you pointed out, you know, he kind of trashed Ginsburg's ideas, you know. And so, I don't know. I think Roger's coasting a bit.
Well, we'll have to see what happens next season, season six. I believe there are just two seasons left, correct?
I think so, yeah. My prediction is 1968. I mean, they'd be crazy to miss that. I mean, all the craziness. And I'm also waiting for the fashions to change. I'm waiting for Don to come in with like a bell-bottom and wide lapel suits and the big fat ties and stuff like that.
Well, this could have been 1966, kind of the calm before the storm, because mm-hmm. you're right, it's 1968, everything could just explode. Mm-hmm. So,
as we say at America, used to say in the 1960s in our editorials, this bears watching.
Well, let's conclude by looking at the show finally through a Catholic lens. That's what we're about here. It seems these characters really have a hole in their lives. They, as I thought more than once watching this this season, their hearts are restless. They seem hungry for something and can't find what it is.
Yeah, and you know, it's a good quote from Augustine. There seems like there's a hole in their lives. And there's so many shots, I notice, of people kind of staring pensively out the window. I mean, you know, Roger does it, you know, when he's like on LSD. But I mean, Don looks out the window a lot. People just seems like they're longing for something. And, you know, without God in their lives, it does seem rather empty. I think I've been surprised that other than the sort of initial appearance of a priest played by Colin Hanks in Peggy's life early on, there's really no mention of religion. And, you know, this is the 1960s, and people were a little more religious. Of course, you had the Time magazine cover, Is God Dead, around that time. But it's striking to me that there's not only is there not God in their lives, which does, in a sense, make it feel like their lives are kind of empty, but they don't even talk about it. There's no sense of, you know, on Sundays, no one goes to church. There's very little, you know, talk even about temple. I mean, you know, Ginsburg, his father sort of prays over him a Jewish prayer, which is very beautiful, but it's kind of notable for its lack of discussion about religious themes when the show itself is really, I think, pretty keyed in on some of these spiritual themes. So it's kind of struck me, especially this last season.
And there are ways to talk about it. I mean, as you said, it was 1966. This is, you know, Vatican II ended in 1965. Mm-hmm. There are ways to get in the subject matter, as you said, the cover of Time magazine. So if they wanted to get into it, there are ways to do it.
Yeah, and they're also, I mean, all these characters are always talking about how they're, in one way or another, they're unsatisfied. You know, I mean, Don talks to Roger, Roger talks to Don, you know, Peggy talks to Joan. I mean, they're all in a different way talking about being unsatisfied, and yet the irony is that none of them ever mention the word. They don't use the G word. They don't talk about religion. They don't talk about faith. They don't talk about meaning in explicitly religious terms. Where in that you know, maybe not in a corporate culture, but in that time, you would have thought that those words would have come to their lips more easily. So it's kind of odd. So God's not in the scriptwriters' minds, and, you know, God's not in their lives, and it does leave a kind of hole in their lives, and I think a little bit of a hole in the show for me, too.
Yeah, but it does kind of make the case in some ways that, you know, without some kind of spirituality or faith, life can be pretty pretty dark and desolate, and it certainly sews that well.
Well, and you know, to your point about you know, Pete's code is no code. I mean, they're casting around for a sort of moral code, and you know, I mean, religion doesn't have all the answers, but I think if some of them were a little more grounded in religious belief and religious practices, they wouldn't be so you know, like a pinball all the time. You know, kind of bouncing from place to place and person to person and ideology to ideology. I just found that. You know, there's kind of this lack of a sort of pole star for a lot of these poor people, I think.
I think your point is a good one, that this is the script is being written by people, you know, in today's generation, where religion isn't as much of a part of people's lives. But if you want to be historically true to that time, you're right. There were people would have been struggling with these questions.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I think these days people don't know the vocabulary of religion. They don't know the right things to say. They wouldn't know you know, how to talk about God, or how people, some people would know how to talk about God, you know. And it's harder, you know, to imagine yourself in the 1960s, how people would talk about God back then. If you don't have an experience of speaking of God in that vocabulary today, it's going to be difficult to understand it in the 1960s. So I do think that represents a certain lack for me in the show, even if they're having a hard time with it. I mean, even if Peggy's going to say, you know, I don't believe in the Catholic Church teaching anymore, or Don says, I don't go to Mass because of X, Y, or Z, but the idea that it wouldn't be any force in their lives seems a little, to me, anachronistic.
Well, they've got two seasons to fix these issues, so we'll look forward to season 6 next year, and we'll do a wrap-up again with Father Jim Martin. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.